the natural nurse and Dr. Z. Hey, this is Dr. Z, and glad to be with you on this exciting program. This is part two of a program that we started with author David Winston. David is an herbalist, third-generation herbalist. He practices, he's very knowledgeable in eclectic medicine, Cherokee medicine, Chinese, and also Western herbal medicine. He's been practicing since 1969. He's also a founding member of the American Herbalist Guild, an internationally known lecturer on a topic of herbal medicines, president of a herb company called Herbalist and Alchemist, and also he is a teacher. He has his own herbal school in New Jersey. He's the author of several books, including Saw Palmetto for Men and Women and Herbal Therapy and Supplements. We're going to be talking about a book today, again, part two, Adaptogens, Herbs for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. David, are you with us?
Back.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad that we could make this happen because we kind of just scratched the surface on adaptogens. Now, because it's part two, let's just bring listeners that maybe didn't connect with part one up to speed, and then we'll get right into talking about the materia medica, things
sure.
that we didn't cover last time. So tell us a little bit about, in your definition in the book, a little bit of the history and actions of adaptogens, and a definition, of course.
Well, basically, an adaptogen, well, I think I'll start with the definition. An adaptogen, by its very nature, is an herb that helps the body to adapt to stress, and that can be psychological stress, physiological stress, noise stress, environmental stress, any type of stressor. And the basic original definition of an adaptogen, this was basically Israel Breckman, who was a Soviet researcher back in the 50s and 60s, was the primary person who did the early research on adaptogens, although there was a Soviet researcher named Lazarov who actually started this research back in the 50s. And basically what they were looking for, it's funny because they were not, this was not benign research. The Soviets were looking for a way to make better soldiers, better workers, better athletes, better cosmonauts in the sense of their competition with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, they were looking for substances that did this. And the original definition of an adaptogen was a substance, number one, that is non-toxic, that helps the body to adapt to a non-specific state of resistance. So it's not a specific thing that you're dealing with, but a whole range of stressors. That these substances basically have relatively little effect on a healthy organism, but have an increasing effect on a unhealthy organism. So therefore, something like a stimulant like caffeine, coffee, tea, is not an adaptogen because they stimulate somebody who is healthy or unhealthy. So these things work primarily through those mechanisms. Now, it was not originally understood how adaptogens work. Later work by a number of researchers, Wagner and Panossian, as well as Breckman, added to this definition, and they said that adaptogens work through two primary mechanisms, one being what's called the HPA axis, or the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This is the interface in our bodies between the endocrine system, the nervous system, and the immune system. So we're talking about control of a wide array of the body's functions. And through a second system called the SAS, the sympathoadrenal system, which is basically our response to acute stress, so the fight-or-flight system. And so basically what they said was adaptogens work via these two systems. And that is indeed true, except that even more recent research, this research came in 2009 and 2010, suggests that adaptogens, while they are doing all of the things we've already mentioned, they are doing something else. And what the other thing they are doing is they are actually working on a cellular level. And this gets rather exciting and fascinating. When we are under chronic stress, a number of things happen. One of them is that we have increased levels of a stress hormone called cortisol. Cortisol increases the amount of nitric oxide released, and the increased amount of nitric oxide and inflammatory prostaglandins and leukotrienes basically downregulates mitochondrial function. So what it turns out is that adaptogens in some ways are acting a little bit like getting a vaccination. So whereas you get a vaccination which triggers your immune system to better respond to a bacteria or a virus, in this case, what happens is we take these adaptogens and they prime our body's ability, that system that responds to stress, and especially a number of cellular molecular signaling compounds, what are known as forkhead proteins and heat shock proteins. And basically what it does, to make a long story short, what it's doing is taking an adaptogen is basically preventing the downregulation of the mitochondria in your cells. And remember, the mitochondria are the energy, you know, the motors of our cells producing ATP, our energy. So this makes tremendous sense, especially when you look at adaptogens being used for things like chronic fatigue, immune deficiency syndrome, and fibromyalgia and other diseases where there is basically chronic fatigue, muscle pain, tiredness, exhaustion, all of these types of conditions where adaptogens are traditionally used. That gives us increasing evidence that not only that they do work, but why they work.
Now, you were talking about the effects of distress on the body and how it kind of seems to affect the entire organism. So it can affect the immune system, right, and give you sort of imbalance in your T cells and B cells and lead to autoimmune disease or reduced immunity where you're carrying around these chronic viral, bacterial, and fungal or stealth infections or things like that. And then also it can, you mentioned it disturbs the central nervous system or the link between the central nervous system and the endocrine system. And I guess that may even correspond to depression and psychosis and things like that. And you mentioned the muscles with fibromyalgia. Of course, the adrenals, I'm sure there's a lot of research on that. And then, of course, there's effects on the gut, too. You mentioned the effects on the cells, antioxidant. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I guess adaptogens can also be used to strengthen people that are undergoing chemo and radiation. Let's talk about these different effects of stress throughout the body and which adaptogen would be more beneficial for that. So let's start with the ones with the viral and chronic fatigue syndrome type of things. A lot of people have this.
Well, basically, everything you said is absolutely correct. You know, stress has far-reaching effects in the body. When we have chronic stress with chronically elevated cortisol levels and chronically elevated adrenaline and things like that, we see it downregulating immune function. We see it interfering with sleep. Mm-hmm. We see it having a suppressive effect on digestion and absorption. Mm-hmm. It affects the gut biome. That's the mass of bacteria, the normal healthy bacteria that live in our gut, which is another fascinating topic because it turns out that it is more transformative in the sense of having activity in the body than the liver is. So it has dramatic effects. It decreases circulation. So then you're looking into peripheral nerve and circulatory issues. So it has extremely wide-ranging effects. And if we talk about something like chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, the first thing I want to say is that when we're looking at adaptogens, I want the listeners to understand that adaptogens are not a replacement for healthy living. So if you are really abusing yourself and you're not getting enough sleep chronically and you're not exercising and you're eating terribly, adaptogens are not going to make up for absolutely abusing your body. On the other hand, for people who are trying to do you know, they're trying to be healthy and live healthy, but they may not exercise as much. They may be under a tremendous amount of stress from work or family life or school or whatever. They're not always getting enough sleep. Adaptogens can make an incredible difference in helping you, as we said, adapt to these stressful situations. But again, we don't want to think of this as a replacement. I can do all these things that I shouldn't do and not do the things that I know that I should do, and I'll take adaptogens.
So it's not like it's not like a Red Bull for these college people. Drink five Red Bulls and go banana.
Yeah, exactly. Because ultimately, under those circumstances, adaptogens just basically allow you to abuse yourself a little bit longer before you crash. But in a case like chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, you have, number one, of course, in my opinion, as a practitioner, when I treat people with chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, the first thing I look at is their sleep, because I actually see it as primarily a sleep disorder. And while adaptogens may or may not be appropriate for dealing with the underlying sleep issue, so if somebody has sleep apnea, then they're probably going to need a CPAP machine or something like that, or a dental device or something to help deal with the obstructive sleep disorder. But adaptogens can help us in this case because, for instance, we have several types of adaptogens. And this is one of the other things that I think is really important for people to understand is adaptogens are not all the same. So it's not just like I want an adaptogen, pick any one. You want to understand that there are differences. Each adaptogen, like every medicinal plant, has a personality. And that personality is that some of them are stimulating, some of them are calming, some of them are heating, some of them are cooling, and some are better for one thing than another. So in the case of something like CFIDs, what we would be looking at is if a person is anxious, we might be looking at an herb like ashwagandha or an herb like jiaogulan or reishi mushroom, which are all calming adaptogens, which would enhance sleep quality and things like that. On the other hand, if we had that same person with chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome and they're really deficient, depleted, they don't have the energy to sleep, and in fact, in Chinese medicine, one of the things that we do is we look at something like insomnia, and is it excess insomnia or deficient insomnia, and they're treated entirely differently. So somebody who doesn't literally have enough energy to sleep, they may be in bed 20 hours a day, but they never actually have the energy to get into a deep, good sleep, we might give them something stimulating like red ginseng or American ginseng or something like shizandraberry to help them have more energy so that they actually can sleep.
Yeah, interesting. Talk about a couple of the those things, the adaptogens that you mentioned. You mentioned something called jiaogulan, which is Dynastema, or it's in the pumpkin family. So we wouldn't think, usually we think of ginseng as roots and barks, although you mentioned, I'm sorry, adaptogens as roots and barks and things like that, although you mentioned that they come from such a plethora of different plants and they're not related botanically or even pharmacologically. They just have this ability. And you mentioned the three-part definition by Brinkman. So tell us about this one that comes from the mountains of China.
Well, jiaogulan is Gymnostoma pentaphyllum, and it is a interesting plant. You're correct. It is in the Cucurbitaceae family, which is the cucumber, melon, pumpkin family. And it's the only plant in that family that we know of that has adaptogenic effects. And it's a bit of an obscure plant in the sense that it's not, even though it's a Chinese medicinal plant, it was not widely used in China. It was primarily used as a folk medicine in southern China. So it comes from mountainous regions of southern China going into northern Vietnam. And so it was a widely used folk remedy, but it was not well known outside of the area where it is native to. And basically the way that this got into greater usage was that Japanese companies were looking for non-caloric sweeteners. And one of the plants that they looked at was this plant because it contains some compounds like stevia that are non-caloric sweeteners. And while they were studying the plant, they found something really unusual. What they found was that the plant contained a number of compounds which they named gympenosides. And several of these japonicides turned out to be absolutely identical chemically to ginsenicides found in ginseng, which startled the researchers because the plants are totally unrelated. They are not even nearby related in family or anything. And it's unusual to find chemicals of this nature, which are often specific to a specific species or genus, to find it in a totally unrelated plant family, but there they were. And so they started doing research on it, primarily, again, in Japan, as an adaptogen, and found out that it is indeed an adaptogen. It is a calming adaptogen, which is nice because some of them are quite stimulating. This one is calming. And so it is used for when people are anxious and irritable and tend to have sort of type A personalities. It's been shown to have cardioprotective effects, and it's used for things like stress-induced palpitations. And genostoma or jiaogulan is more and more being used. And one of the things that's really wonderful is it's really easy to grow, whereas something like ginseng is very difficult to grow and very expensive. Jiaogulan, you can grow it certainly up to zone 6 with ease. And in many places, North Carolina, for instance, it'll overwinter and stay green all winter. Here in New Jersey, where I am, it tends to die back over winter, but it comes back in the spring.
Oh, is that right? So it's not like the annual many, many species of the, you know, melon cucumber family where you have to sow them every year.
No, this one actually is relatively hardy, and if you put it in a, in a zone 6, you put it in a nice microclimate area that's a protected area with some mulch over it, you should have no problem having it grow every year, and it grows like a weed.
That's great. We're going to try
so
that at
you can
our university
grow farm. Large quantities of this, and it's easy to grow, and it tastes nice as a tea.
Any reliable sources of the plant that you know, David, for those gardeners out there that want to maybe attempt this as particularly, because it looks to me, you have a picture in your book there on page 171 of the plant, it kind of looks like a really cool ground cover. It's interesting, it's got a similar leaf than ginseng. It's got that five-fingered leaf, so it's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah. I suspect they can get seeds from Horizon Herbs in Oregon.
Okay.
They probably also might be able to get seeds or maybe even plants from Richter's up in Canada.
Okay, we'll look into that. Tell us a little bit about the other one you mentioned, which is Schisandra. Now, we have that at the University of Bridgeport Garden, and we've actually been able to bring that into fruiting. So this is a very fascinating and oddly tasting fruit adaptogen. So tell us how we would use this one.
Well, Schisandra, the Chinese name is Uet, which means five-flavor fruit. And, of course, in Chinese medicine, there are five flavors, and they are pungent, salty, sweet. I'm missing two.
Bitter. Bitter and sour, right?
Bitter and sour. Thank you very much.
It's okay.
And this one is supposedly has all five flavors, but if most of us would taste it, the two flavors that you would notice most quickly would be sour and turpentine. And so, yes, it does have a rather peculiar taste.
The seed's very bitter. There's a sweetness when you first chew it,
mm-hmm.
and you can immediately taste the sour. Once you crunch into the seed, there's bitter principles in that seed, and it does have a little bit of a burn afterwards.
That's the pungent.
I don't know about the salty. Maybe. Yeah, it's just a very gustatory experience using this thing.
It is rather remarkable, and in fact, there's a guy up in Massachusetts has a place called Amherst Chinese Food, very very creative name, and and he grows Schisandra, and he has about 10 acres of Schisandra berries, and it used to be, I don't know if he still does, I had heard he was going to start bottling it and everything, but it used to be that in the autumn, if you went in there, you could get what he calls Sandra berry juice, which was fresh Schisandra berry juice with a bunch of sugar added to it, and it was interesting tasting and really nice. It was an amazing, energizing drink. So perhaps it's actually more widely available now. But anyway, Schisandra berry It was traditionally used in Chinese medicine for several things. Number one, it was often used in monasteries, and it was drunk by the monks and the Buddhist nuns to help them to meditate, because schizandra does something very interesting. It increases focus and concentration, and at the same time leaves you feeling quite relaxed and calm, which is perfect for meditation. Oh. It was also used in Chinese medicine to do what's called astringe the jing, which in Chinese medicine, jing is primarily associated with the life force, and it's primarily associated with seminal fluid in men. So, for instance, if you have a leaky jing gate and you're losing seminal fluid, you're losing your life force. And you know what they say, it don't mean a thing if you don't got the jing. So the last thing you want is a leaky jing gate. And so it was used for things like to enhance seminal retention, premature ejaculation. It was used for urinary frequency and things of that nature. It is also strongly anti-inflammatory, and it is used for what in Chinese medicine is called kidneys not grasping the lung qi, and that's basically wheezing associated with asthma. Its use as an adaptogen is actually a bit more modern, because it's usually not classified in Chinese medicine as one of the qi tonics. Most of the Chinese adaptogens are considered qi tonics, but this one is not, but it is definitely an adaptogen. It is, as I said, is a calming adaptogen. It is also very strongly hepatoprotective, so it protects the liver against damage from whether it be hepatotoxic viruses, hepatitis A, B, or C. It protects against damage caused by either medications that are hepatotoxic or environmental pollutants that are hepatotoxic. So it is really a rather remarkable herb with a wide variety of activity.
You said also in your book that there's some work with using it for ADHD. I guess that would be more of its calming, focusing ability.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Very interesting.
The only drawback is because of the taste with children, you're going to have some compliance issues. So I primarily use that with adults with ADHD.
Or I guess you could put it in capsules or somehow figure out a
way.
Well,
a lot of kids can't take capsules
very well. Yeah.
So for young children, I wouldn't use it, but for, you know, anybody who's old enough to swallow a capsule, or for an adult who, you know, is able to get beyond the fact that it may not taste fantastic, it's an acquired taste, to say the least. But it's actually, you know, if you use to it for a while, it actually becomes interesting.
We dry them, dry them and eat them, and you know, they're, like I said, they're kind of interesting.
They are.
Tell us a little bit about moving into another area of the world, the Soviet Union. You know, we've kind of been to China. We've talked about some things from India, kind of going back and forth. But in those areas, in those cold areas of the world, we have Eleuthero as a big one, also rhodiola.
Mm-hmm.
And Rapanticum. So maybe you
right.
can kind of tackle those three. Be interesting. Keeping in mind, we have to take a break in about 5 minutes or so.
Okay. Well, Eleuthero, which formerly was known as Siberian ginseng, and of course it got that name primarily as a marketing tool. It's it is distantly related to ginseng, but it is not in the same genus. Eleuthero, basically, when the Soviets were doing this research, the first research on adaptogens was using Asian ginseng, Chinese ginseng, or Korean ginseng. And at the time, even though both the Soviet Union and China were socialist republics, and supposedly, you know, that would make them allies, in fact, they were competitors and not on very good terms. In fact, the two largest standing armies in the world in those times were between basically the Soviet Union and China. They didn't trust each other and they didn't get along. And so the idea that the Russians were going to be paying the Chinese what little hard currency they had to get this herb did not go well. So they decided they needed to find something that grew in Russia or in then the Soviet Union that they could study. And this was the plant that they came up with. And again, Breckman did virtually all the initial research on Eleutherococcus anticosus, or Eleuthero.
Was there folkloric evidence that kind of led them to, I mean, it wasn't just like a random guess that they were looking, or were they screening randomly many, many, many plants looking for adaptogens?
To my knowledge, there was not, and I think I would have come across that if there had been.
Right.
I think what they found was it was in the Aureliaceae family, and so they decided to look at other members, and it was quite common. It grows all over the taiga in Siberia, and I think they decided to look at it primarily because of the family relationship and some of the similarity in chemistry.
Sure.
But I don't believe it was traditionally used. It certainly was not used in Chinese medicine as a sort of adaptogenic remedy.
Mm.
So Eleuthero, it turns out, is a good adaptogen, and it's one of the interesting ones in that it is rather neutral energetically. It is not heating. It is not cooling. It is not stimulating particularly. It is not calming. It's right in the middle. And as such, I think it is one of the adaptogens that is best for younger people. So when we are talking about people in their late teens, in their 20s, when you're talking about your college student who is, you know, has finals and things like that, I think this is one of the most appropriate ones there because it does not have some of the more profound effects that some of the other ones that we're talking about, Asian ginseng and things like that. Eleuthero also is very, very useful for people who are easily overstimulated by the real ginsengs. So Asian ginseng can overstimulate some people, and even American ginseng rarely can overstimulate some people. But Eleuthero, that is extremely unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is also, in my mind, really useful for people who are in training. They're training for a marathon, athletes. You know, when I was in day-to-day clinical practice, I still see some people, but I don't have a day-to-day practice anymore. When I was in day-to-day practice, I had a number of athletes, people who were world-class triathletes and things like that, and using adaptogens as well as other things to, you know, work on their overall, improving overall health, we were able to get some significant improvements in people's times and their training times using these types of things.
So they're able to train. They're able to train more vigorously and repair their body in between, or how does it tend to work like that?
Well, yes, exactly. They are able to train more vigorously. They can recover more quickly.
Mm.
And when we talked before, now we know. I didn't know this then, and no one knew this then, but basically one of the things that's happening is rigorous training has the same effect of increasing cortisol levels and basically shutting down mitochondria. So these adaptogens are basically preventing the mitochondria to basically be inhibited by excess levels of nitric oxide.
Right. Interesting. And how does one use Eleuthero? Do you use the standardized extract with the Eleuthero sides? Do you just dig it up in the yard and make it into a tea? How generally do people use this particular plant?
Well, if you had it growing in your yard, yes, you could dig it up and dry it and make tea and make a decoction out of it. But since most people don't, Eleuthero can be used in multiple ways. The way I wouldn't use it is I wouldn't take the ground up herb in a capsule. I think that would be because the herb is primarily a wood. We do not have the digestive power to break down, you know, woody material, even when it's ground into a powder. So I think that would be the least effective way of taking it. If you get Eleuthero, one of the things I'd mention to people is this is an herb that has been adulterated frequently in the American marketplace. Most often the adulteration is through ignorance, not through intention, but it has been adulterated with a toxic herb called paraploca. And the average person could not tell these apart. So make sure you're getting your Eleuthero from a company that tests and make sure that what they are getting is actually Eleuthero. And any good quality company should be doing this at this point. If anybody's following GMPs, the good manufacturing practices, they have to be testing, you know, their products. But make sure that they are compliant with these things. And so under those circumstances, it could be done as a tea, and it would be a decoction where you basically bring the herb to a sort of simmering boil, and you'd probably do that for 15 to 20, even 30 minutes, and then let it steep or sit for another hour. and then strain that. And that would make an effective tea from Eleuthero. You can also use it as a tincture, which is a very easy form, and it's an alcohol and water extract. It can also be taken in pills, but not the ground-up herb, but in this case it would be a what's called a spray-dried extract. These are usually, it'll say in the label, a 4-to-1 or a 5-to-1 extract. And then there are extracts that are standardized to specific compounds, in this case what are known as eleuthericides. Because we don't entirely understand and know all of the activity of this plant in the sense of chemically, we know that certain compounds seem to be active, but we don't know that, you know, all of the active compounds. The issue with standardization is problematic because in some cases you might have a product standardized to a specific compound. An example would be a non-adaptogenic herb like St. John's wort standardized to 0.3% hypericin, when it turns out that hypericin is not only the active ingredient, it's not even one of the primary active ingredients. So standardization in some cases, like with milk thistle or saw palmetto, can be useful, but it's not always the answer.
Right, right. Well, we'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with David Winston and his book, Adaptogens, Herbs for Strength, Stamina, and Stress Relief. Stay tuned. And we're back with the natural nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z. And, of course, we all deal with stress every day, and every day our bodies strive to adapt and stay balanced and healthy. In the book Adaptogens, authors David Winston and Stephen Mimes provide a comprehensive look into adaptogens, the non-toxic herbs like ginseng, eleuthero, and licorice, which we want to touch on soon, that produce basically a good response to stress in our body. These rejuvenating herbs and tonics help our body adapt to the many influences and encounters. They increase stamina and counter the normal effects of aging and are important tools in sports medicine, prevention, geriatrics, treatment of chronic fatigue, and other stress-related disorders. And that's a little bit from the back cover of our guest David Winston's book. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Thanks, yeah. You know, you mentioned licorice. Now, that's kind of an interesting plant because a lot of people misunderstand licorice, particularly our friends in the allopathic world who avoid it like the plague or tell their patients that it's a very dangerous herb. It'll to drive their blood pressure up to very high amounts, and there's a lot of misinformation about that, yet it's such an incredible plant ally. Tell us a little bit about licorice and why you included it in your book as an adaptogen.
Well, actually, the evidence for licorice being an adaptogen is pretty good. And you're right, there is a lot of misinformation about licorice. Now, the reality is licorice can cause what's called a pseudo-hyperaldosterogenic effect. And what that means is that if you take too much licorice, it can cause you to retain sodium and excrete potassium, and then the effect of that is increased blood pressure, possibly also arrhythmias and things like that. So the key to using licorice and to using licorice safely has to do with dosage. Licorice is the most commonly used herb in Chinese medicine, and Chinese medicine is widely used throughout China, and there are virtually no cases of hyperaldosterogenic effects from licorice in China. So the problem is that when we start looking at the literature and we look at cases of people having this hyperaldosterogenic effect, the first case that came to mind is one that basically this guy was eating these natural licorice candies. Now, understand that most licorice in the marketplace, the candy licorice, has no real licorice in it whatsoever.
Yeah, you're not talking Twizzlers, you know.
We're not talking Twizzlers. But there's a natural licorice product on the marketplace that's made from a solid extract of licorice, and this product is perfectly safe. Except that this guy was eating two boxes of these candies a day.
They are good. That's for sure.
They're very good, but you know, two boxes a day is probably is too much, and because you're dealing with a product made from a solid extract, which means it's highly concentrated.
Right.
The second case that that came to light was basically a guy who was chewing tobacco flavored with licorice solid extract, and this guy not only liked to chew tobacco, he liked to swallow the juice, which is gross, but then again, chewing and spitting is not my all-time favorite thing to look at either. So we have people using these highly concentrated extracts and taking in huge quantities. The third case that I know of was a woman drinking 4 cups of licorice tea a day. Now, I don't know how many of our listeners have drunk licorice tea, but licorice contains a chemical called glycyrrhizin, which is 500 times sweeter than sugar. So we are talking about something that is incredibly sweet. So drinking 4 cups of nothing but licorice tea a day is a huge dose.
Mm.
So what you see is, how come the Chinese don't have a problem? The reason is the Chinese use a small amount of licorice in a formula with a lot of other herbs. You don't need a lot of licorice. And if
they
you
use
remember,
it as, they use it as like a driver in the formula. Talk about what
they use it to
how it functions in there.
Yeah, they use it to harmonize the formula and reduce toxicity or irritation caused by some of the harsher herbs in the formula.
Don't they say it enters all the meridians? I've read quite a number of accounts of that in TCM books.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And so basically they're using it to basically enhance activity of the overall formula. But again, they're using a very small amount. You don't need a lot of licorice to get the benefits of licorice. And licorice, of course, not only is it an adaptogen, licorice has a wide variety of activities. It basically acts as a very effective cough suppressant. Licorice helps heal the gastric mucosa for things like gastritis and gastric ulcers. It can be useful for helping to heal the intestinal mucosal tissue, things like IBS, IBD, mucus colitis, Crohn's disease. Licorice is strongly anti-inflammatory, and it is also a very important thing for licorice. It is what is known as an immune amphoteric. And while not all adaptogens are immune amphoterics, many are. An immune amphoteric is an herb that helps to re-regulate the immune system, whether it is hypofunctioning or hyperfunctioning. And so what that means is, if you have immune deficiency, be it from chronic Lyme disease, from something like chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, cancer, any number of conditions where there's immune suppression, licorice will strengthen and nourish the immune system. And so many other adaptogens will do this as well. Things like the ginsengs will do this, and Eleuthera will do this. Ashwagandha will do this. So it can do that, but it also, if you have hyperactivity in the immune system, either things like allergies, which is out-and-out immune hyperactivity, or you have autoimmune disease, which is a combination usually of basically a prematurely aged immune system and overstimulation of at least one aspect of the immune system, it can help there as well. And so somebody might say, well, how does it know what to do? It doesn't know what to do. Basically, your immune system is a self-regulatory system, and when it becomes unhealthy, when it becomes disordered, it loses the ability to regulate itself. And so what these immune amphoterics can do is help nourish and strengthen the immune system so it regains its self-regulatory capacity.
So it can help heal itself. Now, of course, as a practitioner, I've used licorice to, you know, get people off of prednisone and things like that, so I'm not really using it in the adaptogenic sense. So this is something that can be used in a different way based on the dose. So it's very dose specific whether it has an adaptogenic effect or you're actually looking for that effect to, say, like wean someone off of prednisone. Or what's your feelings about that? I know you've dealt with a lot of people with rheumatic illnesses, autoimmune diseases, etc.
Well, one of the things that licorice does is licorice actually potentiates prednisone. And so, therefore, when you start using licorice, and you have to be careful. I wouldn't recommend people try this on their own.
Right.
You need to go to a
practitioner. Only, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But you basically can start lowering the prednisone dose while you use licorice. It enhances the effects of the prednisone and reduces the side effects if it's used correctly. You're still getting an adaptogenic effect at that point, but you might use a higher dose. dose. Uh-huh. You might also use the DGL licorice under those circumstances, which is a licorice where the glycyrrhizinic acid has been removed so that it doesn't cause those hyperaldosterogenic effects.
Right, and what's left of the various flavonoids and chalcones and things like that in DGL, and that's one of the best things in, I know, in Europe potentially for treating peptic ulcers and other gastritis and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. It's extremely anti-inflammatory and healing to the gastric and gut mucosa.
Let's talk a little bit about rhodiola mm-hmm. and rapanticum, kind of go back to the high up in the Siberia, because these are, rhodiola particularly is becoming much more popular. You know, you mentioned rhodiola, and people are starting to kind of know a little bit about it. Tell us a little bit about those two plants.
Well, rhodiola, which is also known as rose root, and the reason it's called rose root is that the true rhodiola rosea, and there are many species of rhodiola, and I'll talk about a bit more about that in a minute, but rhodiola rosea has a lot of essential oils in the root which give it the smell of basically rose geranium, and so hence the name rose root. Now, people need to be aware that a lot of the rhodiola in the United States, you look in herb company catalogs and it'll say rhodiola and it'll often say source and it'll say China. Well, rhodiola rosea doesn't come from China. And so if the rhodiola is coming from China, it's probably not the right species. Mm. So people need to be aware of that. But rhodiola rosea basically grows in the northern circumpolar regions throughout the northern hemisphere. So it's found in Canada. It's found sparsely in Maine. It's found in Scandinavia. It's found in places like Latvia, Siberia. And it is in the sedum family. So a lot of people have sedums as in their rock gardens.
Like rockweed,
That's
succulent.
Yeah, it is a succulent, but of course it's not the ones that people have growing in their gardens, although they have a beautiful collection of this at the Montreal Botanical Garden.
Wow.
They have a lovely collection of true rhodiola.
Wow.
A friend of mine, Alain Carrier, is the ethnobotanist there, and he's gone on collecting trips and brought it back.
I tried growing it down here in Connecticut in my rock garden amongst the other sedums. It didn't fare too well. I don't know what I did wrong.
I think, among other things, our summers are just way too hot.
Too hot.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a plant that grows, in the far north, and,
right.
We probably have too much rain and probably too much humidity and just too much heat in the summertime, maybe even in the winter for that matter. But anyway, rhodiola has a long history of use. It was used by the Vikings, and for whatever we want to say about the Vikings historically, they lived a hard life, and they used it as a tonic, an energy tonic.
Hmm.
And so traditionally this plant has been used, and in this plant primarily the research has been done in Sweden, a place called the Swedish Herbal Institute, by a researcher named Panosian. And rhodiola is interesting. It is a stimulating adaptogen. And so you do need to be aware that if you're a person that is easily overstimulated, if you're the kind of person that eats like a little piece of chocolate after lunch, you can't fall asleep at night, rhodiola may overstimulate you too. People do need to be aware of that. It is also fairly drying. So for people who tend toward dryness, dry mouth, dry skin, dry eyes, vaginal dryness, things like that, this herb is drying and dispersing. So because of that, there are certain people where you wouldn't necessarily want to use rhodiola, or you might want to combine it with other things to help modify the dispersing, drying, and stimulating effects. But having said that, most people can take rhodiola without any problem, and there are dozens and dozens of studies on rhodiola, many human studies, showing activity, showing that it enhances athletic performance. Rhodiola also has benefits enhancing cardiovascular health. Rhodiola also stimulates male and female sexual functioning. In men, it improves erectile function. And no, it is not an herbal Viagra. It's nothing like that. It's not like you're going to take Rhodiola and be ready to go in 15 minutes. But taking Rhodiola over a period of several months can enhance erectile function in men. It's been shown to improve fertility in women. So it has a dramatic number of effects. And like most adaptogens, it basically enhances HPA axis function, so it's enhancing immune function. It's enhancing overall endocrine function, pancreatic function, especially the endocrine effects of the pancreas as opposed to the digestive effects of the pancreas. It's basically enhancing nervous system function, and it's, again, it's widely studied.
You know, I was talking to Australian herbalist Kerry Bone, and he was saying that he felt that while many of these adaptogens seem to help the adrenal cortex, which is kind of the outside of the adrenal that makes the glucocorticoids and mineral corticoids, you know, the steroidal-like, pardon me, steroidal-like molecules, this tends to help the inside of the adrenals, the medulla of the adrenals, where epinephrine and norepi, and also the central nervous system levels of norepi and things like that. So it seems he felt it was tied into the tyrosine, dopamine, phenylalanine type pathways. I don't know if you ever read anything about that, but I thought that was fascinating, and I'm trying to dig up some research to support that.
Well, it's interesting, but I would agree with your comment in that there's no data that I've come across that says that that's true. So, okay. I mean, Kerry's a phenomenally good herbalist, and you know, I would take what he says with, you know, seriously. On the other hand, I think that there may be some accuracy, some validity to what he is saying, and at the same time, I would say that I don't think you could say that most adaptogens just work on the outer cortex. I think most of them work.
Or the inner medulla, right? Yeah. Well,
I think
understand.
They do. I think most of them do both.
But it was interesting. I think that maybe some of them have more of a preference for one part than the other, or somehow the
body.
Well,
that might be true, and that might be why some of them are calming and some of them are stimulating.
Exactly. I thought that was that's exactly kind of how our conversation ended up, that maybe that's why, you know, some tend to have a relaxation effect and some tend to be stimulating, like the rhodiola. I mean, people notice, they notice that. You know, some of these, it's interesting, some of these adaptogens they're very subtle in their action, and some of them are fairly obvious and more quick-acting. I would put rhodiola in the more fast-acting adaptogenic plants, or maybe it's just that the patient's more sensitive to it and they feel it because they're more depleted. I'm not really sure what's happening there.
Yeah, I can't say that the data, you know, exists that tells us that, but I would say you certainly things like red ginseng, certainly things like rhodiola, you feel it relatively quickly, whereas something like reishi mushroom or codenopsis or jiaogulan, the effect is much more subtle, and you really need to take it over a period of time before you'll notice any real significant effects.
I think that's important to, you know, tell patients, you know, because if they're if they're expecting these adaptogens to work very quickly to repair what's been years and years of abuse and damage, I think you have to set it straight before people give up on taking them. They have to realize that they're kind of in the long haul taking adaptogens, that they have to be like a daily practice, like meditation and eating better and things like that, that while used over the long haul, we're talking measuring progress in quarter of a year versus, you know, days or weeks. Would you agree with that, David?
I would definitely agree with that. Adaptogens are not something you take because you didn't get sleep last night and you want to have a, you know, that's where stimulants are used.
Right.
You know, basically adaptogens, yes, are long-term remedies that are taken over considerable periods of time, certainly weeks or months, sometimes more than that. And they basically are used, you know, to enhance overall function. But as I said earlier, they're not a replacement for chronic lack of sleep or chronic lack of exercise or a chronically poor diet. But we definitely want, you know, people to understand how do adaptogens work. But at the same time, you're correct in that some of them do have a, you know, like a rhodiola or like a red ginseng, have a stimulating effect that you may notice in days.
Now, lastly, there's one called Rapanticum, which I have no experience using. This is one that I'll be listening intently. Not that I haven't been listening to the whole show, because it's been fascinating. But this is one that I don't really know a lot about, and it also kind of grows in the similar area that the rhodiola grows in.
Yeah, it's a Siberian plant, and there is some people are discussing whether the it's also known as Lutzia. Lutzia or Rapanticum are synonyms for one another. And so if you do research on it, you may get as much information if you put in the word Lutzia, L-E-U-E-Z-A, as if you put in Rapanticum. This is one that the Russians and Soviets and Russians have been working with and studying for about 30 or 40 years. Mm. So it's an official in the now current Russian pharmacopoeia, and it is used as an adaptogen. Whether the stuff that is growing, that is cultivated, is as good as the material that is wild, that's the question. Mm-hmm. And it has been over-harvested, like many things, in the wild, so hopefully the cultivated material is as good, because, you know, we can't keep gathering something that just isn't reproducing quickly. And, you know, of course, it's a very short growing season in Siberia. It is also known as marrow root, named after the marrow deer, who supposedly, the folklore goes, the way that the indigenous people in Siberia learned to use this plant is they watched the deer eat it, especially during the winter, where they would sort of dig up the roots and eat them, and it would help them to survive these incredibly harsh winters. So the Russians have been using it, as I said, for 30 or 40 years, and they use it, again, for athletes to enhance performance. They use it for regular chronic stress. I have used it myself only a small amount because it's hard to get, and that's one of the problems with it. I've been able to get it a few times out of Europe. I do not know if anybody is producing a Rapanticum product. There's one product here I know of that has Rapanticum in it, but a pure Rapanticum product I have yet to see in the United States. But I have been able to get products out of Scandinavia that are just Rapanticum. Mm. And my experience using Rapanticum is that, like some of the adaptogens we mentioned earlier, like Jiaogulan, it is a non-stimulating adaptogen. This is one you'd use over a period of time. But one of my favorite studies on Rapanticum was they gave it to people who were alcoholics recovering from chronic alcohol abuse and were depressed. And so depression is very common in people who are going through alcohol withdrawal. And so this was given as a tea, obviously, not as a tincture. And these people basically took the Rapanticum for a period of about, I think it was 6 weeks, and many of them had significant benefits in the alcohol-induced depression. And not only did they have significant benefits, the benefits lasted for up to 6 months.
Wow. Well, I'm looking at the time, and I want to do some type of a kind of a recap or basically just get your closing thoughts about ways that patients can use adaptogens, and certainly give out information about your book. Unfortunately, there's other sections of the book. Let me just review that. There's some, of course, case reviews on Chapter 10, Clinical Use Adaptogens, where David's gone around to various colleagues and himself and have done some interesting cases from other herbal practitioners. And then he's got a little section on using adaptogens as food, some great recipes here, and then also mixing adaptogens with other kind of plants like nervines, which are things that kind of help your nervous system, and nootropics. Those are kind of like the smart drugs or smart plants that enhance activity of the mind and memory and things like that. So it seems like the adaptogens go well with many other plants as part of a more complicated formula.
Well, you know, as an herbalist, there are two things that I would say. Number one, I believe a good herbalist treats people, not diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Hippocrates said it's more important to know the person that has the disease than the disease the person has. And so, you know, I have my two-year herb studies program, and we have a new class starting up in September. And for listeners, it is both a live class and an online class, a live online class, so people can take it. And we have students in all over the United States and England.
What's the website? Ireland. What's the website there?
That is herbalstudies.net.
Herbalstudies.net.
Correct. Anyway, with that, in the herb studies program, one of the things that I have to teach people is to focus in not just diseases, but treating the whole person. And so we want to use adaptogens not just for disease, but which one is right for this person and which things is it best combined with to help this person we're treating live a happier, healthier, and longer life.
Right. David Winston, boy, I tell you, it's always great to have you on. We got to see you in the flesh, and I promise to invite you down to the university to do some lectures here.
I'd love to come.
Okay, and I know you're pretty close in New Jersey. We've been reviewing the book Adaptogens, Herbs for Stress, Stamina, and Stress Relief. This is Dr. Z and the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. Stay healthy, folks. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.